From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has lashed out at the muted global response to the killing of dozens of Palestinians during protests this week along the Israel-Gaza border. Tüm dünya gözünü yumsa da. Mr. Erdogan criticized the UN as having ended. It has become an exhausted and collapsed institution. He spoke of the silence that greeted what he called Israeli bullying. Turkey's diplomatic response to the violence was swift, expelling Israel's ambassador, followed by the consul general. It also recalled its ambassador to Tel Aviv. Israel reprimanded a top Turkish diplomat and told the Turkish consul general to leave. Emmanuel Nakshon is an Israeli foreign ministry spokesman.
The images of our ambassador being subjected to an unnecessary security check are spread all over Turkey. This is something that we cannot accept. This is something which is totally contrary to diplomatic relations between countries. And the public humiliation of an ambassador is something that Israel will not accept under any circumstance.
Meanwhile, Hamas, which rules Gaza, acknowledged all but a dozen of the 62 killed Monday and Tuesday were members of the Islamist group. In Kenya, the sounds of mourning. A memorial service held Wednesday to remember the victims of flooding in Kenya following a May 9 dam collapse from heavy rainfall that killed more than 40 people. 2 months of heavy rain followed an extended drought affecting four countries. Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan announced progress Wednesday on consultations surrounding Africa's largest hydroelectric dam project, the $5 billion Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on the Nile River. Egypt has expressed concern about the potential for constricting the river's water flow. This is VOA News. European leaders Wednesday agreed on a united approach to keeping the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement alive. Speaking in Sofia, Bulgaria, European Council President Donald Tusk committed to what he called a rules-based international system, despite recent U.S. decisions on climate change, tariffs, and Iran.
Europe will either be one of the major players or a pawn.
The comments came after the U.S. this month pulled out of the nuclear agreement with Tehran. Meanwhile, French energy giant Total warned it and other multinationals may have to quit Iran as the U.S. reimposes nuclear sanctions. The Islamic holy month of Ramadan got underway Thursday, a date set by Saudi religious authorities. It is one of the five pillars of Islam. It involves dusk to dawn fasting and prayer. The former Mufti of Jerusalem, Sheikh Akrama Sabri, said it's a generous and dear month. Generous in fasting, generous in worship, generous by having the manners of a fasting person. India Wednesday announced its troops would halt counterinsurgency operations in disputed Kashmir during the month of Ramadan. Burundians head to the polls Thursday in a referendum that could allow President Pierre Nkurunziza, in power since 2005, to stay there until 2034. Nearly 500,000 people have fled the country when he announced a third term in 2015. The opposition complained of intimidation, including death threats, during a three-month campaign leading up to Thursday's referendum. President Donald Trump suggested the path forward to a much-anticipated meeting with North Korea leader Kim Jong-un next month is unclear. The North suggested the meeting could be in jeopardy over joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises and demands over its denuclearization. Former U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill said the chance of a meeting he believes is now less than 50%.
I think the Trump administration has perhaps done a little too much talk in public about it and not enough preparation for the actual summit. And so as the president's been doing some victory laps, it seems to me he should have understood that he first has to run the race.
China Wednesday said the U.S.-North Korean talks should go on as planned. The North abruptly canceled high-level talks scheduled Wednesday with South Korea. Seoul said those talks were to have focused on easing border tensions and discussions about reunions of families separated by the Korean War. China and the U.S. are set to launch crucial trade talks in Washington Thursday in a bid to avert a damaging tariff war. The White House Trade and Manufacturing Advisor Peter Navarro will not be the principal negotiator on the U.S. side, that role relegated to Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. Liu He, an advisor to China's President Xi Jinping, will lead the Chinese delegation. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundians are voting today in a referendum that some say will keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034.
Despite all the intimidation, threats and everything, people will decide their own destiny. Because this is not the first time there is a big challenge.
Agathon Raza is an opposition leader and deputy speaker of parliament. $6 million for agricultural projects in three East African countries. Dakar University students protest the police killing of their own. And Cameroon's government finalizes plans for this Sunday's celebration of the country's National Day.
It is not Southern Cameroon's National Day. It is not Ambazonian National Day. It is a national day for celebration for the Republic of Cameroon because what they are celebrating is the conquering of Southern Cameroon.
Christmas Ibini is an elder supporter of Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonian secessionist movement. A UN official criticized the continuing kidnapping of aid workers in South Sudan, and West Africa taps solar energy potential. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundians are voting today, Thursday, in a constitutional amendment referendum that some say, if passed, will keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. President Nkurunziza has ruled Burundi since the end of the country's civil war in 2005. Nkurunziza won a third term in a violent election in 2015. The opposition said then that the election was a violation of the country's constitution. Moses Habyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
It was a grim situation here in Cibitoki on the eve of the country's historical day to amend the 2005 constitution that will see the presidential term extended from 5 to 7 years. The Burundi government conducted a mass funeral for the 26 people killed in Cibitoki province, located in northwestern part of the country. Joseph Iteriteka is the governor of Cibitoki. He says that terrorist groups came from neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo and that all neighboring countries should come together in order to stop that group. Today, Burundians are at the polling station to vote for or against the constitution amendment. There is visibly beefed up security in the country's capital since last night. Burundi's opposition leader and deputy speaker of the parliament, Agathon Rwasa, said that he is optimistic that Burundians will reject the bill.
Despite all the intimidation, threats and everything, people will decide of their own destiny because this is not the first time there is a big challenge in 1961, 1993, and even 2005, and even today.
Among the articles that are most likely to be amended other than the presidential term limit is Article 49 of the current constitution that indicates that a Burundian can be extradited abroad if he is prosecuted by an international criminal court for genocide crimes, war crimes or other crimes against humanity. If amended, no Burundian can be extradited. Jean-Claude Bigirimana is a citizen in Bujumbura and talks about his feeling about the referendum.
I think good about it. It's not a problem for a citizen like me. And I'm happy about these referendums because the government is trying to put power in the citizen. We are the one to decide. So I don't have any problem with it and I am ready to go and vote. We are ready to do that.
The international community criticized the Burundi government's move to conduct a referendum at a time when the regional mediated dialogue is yet to come to an end. However, Burundi government and ruling supporters believe that the referendum will guarantee peace and stability in the country. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
East African member countries have secured $6 million to help farmers in three East African countries, Uganda, Kenya, and Rwanda. Maganda Julius Wandera, Uganda's Minister for East African Affairs, says the funds will be used to increase both the quantity and the quality of farmers' produce. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarich has the story from Kampala.
The funds were secured by Kilimo Trust, an East African-based organization that promotes agro-business development from Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA, and the three partner states. Minister Wandela says the funds will help farmers increase yield and eradicate perennial famine in the region.
So while we are saying Uganda has a surplus production, do we reach the requirement in quality? And those also will be addressed in this whole program. So we have targets in maize, we have targets in beans, we have targets where we are looking at potatoes. These are also areas, and if you want to cure hunger in your family, you go for potatoes, because it is something that you can run for a longer period of time before you even conclude the whole garden.
At least 300,000 farmers, mainly women and youth, will be provided with financial assistance and educated on modern farming methods. Wandela says increased yields will also help boost regional trade.
The trade within Uganda, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, within the region is at 11%. But we are even trading in a subsistence kind of production. It's not established or finished or value-added products, which are really identifiable. You find that the value-added products is very minimal. Now, in this kind of program also has an element where we are supposed to even to do value addition. We are supposed to do commercial, and where they are supposed to earmark the market, the demands of the market within the region.
Dr. Birungi Korotaro is the head of Kilimo Trust in Uganda. She says they expect at least 120,000 metric tons of agricultural products valued at over $60 million to be traded in across the region.
We'll build their capacity in terms of supporting them to understand how best they can use fertilizers, improved seed, so that they can produce higher yields. And also we will give them the guaranteed market so that what they produce is actually sold to a particular buyer, either a processor, a trader, or a retailer, either in national markets or in regional markets.
The project will be for a duration of 5 years in Uganda and 3 years in Rwanda and Kenya. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Preparations are in their final stages for this Sunday's May 20th Cameroon 46th National Day celebration. It is the day in 1972 when Cameroonians voted for a unitary state against the then federal system. The theme of this year's celebration is Cameroonian citizens, let us remain united in diversity and preserve social peace for a stable, indivisible and prosperous Cameroon. The day comes amid a nearly two-year-long uprising in the country's English-speaking southwestern northwestern regions against what the citizens there called their marginalization by the predominantly French-speaking government of Cameroon. Christmas Ibini is an elder supporter of the self-proclaimed Abanzonian secessionist movement of Cameroon. He says the 20th May celebration has no significance to southern Cameroonians because it signifies the enslavement of the people of South Cameroon.
Well, I am glad, James, you said Cameroon National Day. It is not Southern Cameroon's National Day. It is not Ambazonian National Day. It is a national day for celebration for the Republic of Cameroon, because what they are celebrating and taking Southern Cameroonians as their slaves. That 20th May has no significance to Southern Cameroonians. People in our midst were celebrating it in the past by armed force from La République du Cameroun. This time around, our people have come to understand their history and the significance to them of that day. That is the day that the French and the La République du Cameroun went away from the terms of union between La République du Cameroun and Southern Cameroon. Article 47 of that contract under the 1961 Constitution stated very clearly that no action should be taken to change the structure and the agreement of the union between Southern Cameroons and La République du Cameroun from a federal structure to anything else. So that is a day of celebration for the conquerors and the abusers of La République du Cameroun, and we would not celebrate it.
The theme of Sunday's celebration is Cameroonian citizens, let us remain united in diversity and preserve social peace for a stable, indivisible and prosperous Cameroon. The government is reaching out.
Minister James, my brother, you are a man of news, and I know that you know history. you know well affairs very well, and you talk to me about preaching peace. How do you preach peace to a people when you chase them from their homes into the forest, into refugee camps? How do you preach peace when you go to towns and villages and set them ablaze, roasting elderly people and children inside the homes? How do you preach peace by violating people's rights constantly? How do you seek unity by waterboarding innocent citizens? Tell me, is that preaching peace? Their actions are there for the world to see.
I know you've been agitating for some time, but one of the issues, one or two of the issues, was that the issue about education in the Southern Cameroon and the use of French in the schools, and also the legal system. President Paul Biya, just as a way of trying to address these issues, ordered the recruitment of at least about 1,000 young bilingual science and technical teachers. That's one thing, again, to say maybe the government realizes and is trying to correct the mistake of the past.
Well, they can do that for themselves. What we know and what we see and what we have felt, their action from the time when the lawyers and teachers were begging them to dialogue, to change a few things, what did they do? They arrested them and put them in jail. Most of those guys whom they arrested at that time were people who were advocating for federalism. There were those who were begging them for unity. There were those who were begging them for peace. There were those who were begging them to cohabit with Southern Cameroonians as their own brothers, respecting their rights and everything. What did they do? They arrested them and put them in jail. Even their own Supreme Court judge, who was asking for regional decentralization, which does not meet, is not even in the spirit of the Southern Cameroon's quest, was arrested and locked up for 8 months. Is that what you call solving a problem? They may write on paper that, oh, they are recruiting teachers. This is not the first time they started recruiting teachers. The legal system is still the same. We have civilians who are in jail, and they keep taking them every time to military courts. These are civilians who are not armed. And you say that's solving the problem? No, sir. They don't want to solve the problem. They will have declared war against us. They want to treat us as slaves in our own land. And that is unacceptable. We would resist that to the last man standing.
Christmas Ibini is an elder supporter of the self-proclaimed Ambazonian Secessionist Movement of Cameroon. You are speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, May 17th. Daybreak Africa time is now 18 minutes past the hour. Students burned cars and threw rocks this week at the University of Dakar in response to the police killing of a student during the protest at another Senegalese university. Earlier this week, students in St. Louis were protesting what they said was the government's inaction in paying their scholarships when police opened fire and killed student Falou Sen. The protests mark a continuation of year-long marches and demands by students. The students say the government is not living up to its responsibilities. Their leader, Massou Sen, spoke to Ricky Stryak about what action they want the government to take in order to stop the protests.
All children are angry about what will happen yesterday. The reason why they are just going on struggle. This denotes what is happening. This denotes the situation of students, because we know that the authority don't respect the students. We tire out every year. Each government come and kill a student. We have in the case of Bosnia, and yesterday we have in the case of Falun.
Students have been protesting for a while now about the conditions of the university. So can you tell me a little bit more about this? This isn't just a reaction to this one event, I think. This is kind of on top of all of the frustrations you guys have been feeling. Is that correct?
If you say that at the end of the month, we will pay you your scholarship, they will never do it at time. And we can say here also the situation of the university is more than complicated, or is becoming more and more complicated each year.
The problem is not just the scholarships, though, correct? The problem is overcrowding. The problem is a lack of supplies. Is that correct?
Really, we're not in good condition. We're all in bad condition. It's the same in the social campus, but also it is the same in the pedagogical campus. You know, when we go to study there in the pedagogy campus,
we have the same problem. The problem become more and more complicated. The problem become more and more the same thing.
Can you tell me a little bit about your group, Carbon 14, Carbon 14? When were you guys started and why?
Just the Carbon 14 movement is a movement in which you will find students. It is about the fight of Sheikh Anta Diop. The students who love Sheikh Anta Diop, because you know that Sheikh Anta Diop, even if it is a Senegal, he is a Senegalese, but right now the Senegalese people don't know who is Sheikh Anta Diop. And as our students, we have said that it is one of our struggles must be how we can do to make students or to make Senegalese people to know who is Sheikh Anta Diop. The reason why me as an artist, I'm preparing just the an album. And the album is an album which will render homage to Sheikh Anta Diop. Why? It's just to do a participation about just to put people to go far, just to try to know who is Sheikh Anta Diop, because they don't know Sheikh Anta Diop.
That was Masu Hussein, president of the student activist group Carbon 14. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. A top UN official visiting South Sudan says he is deeply disappointed by continuing kidnappings and abductions of aid workers by South Sudan's warring parties, as well as the decreasing impediment to humanitarian assistance. Dino Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Mark Lowcock, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, says more than 10 aid workers have been abducted in South Sudan in the past 2 months.
In the last 2 months alone, 4 aid workers have been killed, and that takes the total killed since the conflict began to more than 100. Most of them are the citizens of South Sudan. Crimes are being committed against aid workers with apparent impunity. There needs to be accountability. And the government, because it is the government, and this is a responsibility of governments everywhere, have the prime responsibility for that.
Lowcock says both the government and the armed opposition have done too little to end the violence and prevent their forces from obstructing aid workers from reaching the people in need of assistance.
But not only has the violence increased, but humanitarian agencies are increasingly impeded from saving lives by the restrictions of the operating environment. And what we need is rapid, safe, unhindered access to all people in need. When I discussed these issues with the government here in Juba yesterday, they assured me that they want humanitarian agencies to have unimpeded access to everyone who needs help, wherever they are. But unfortunately, that is not the situation that prevails at the moment. The aid agencies are subject to harassment, extortion, looting, kidnappings, killings, predatory fees and levies, and other blockages all over the country.
Lowcock visited a UN Protection of Civilian site in Yei Town of Yei River State today to see firsthand how the conflict is affecting civilians, especially women and children. He says all the IDPs he met told him they want South Sudan's leaders to immediately stop the fighting.
The people we've met both yesterday here in Juba and today in both Yei Town, which is under government's control, and Mundu, which is under the opposition control, when you ask them what they want, the first thing they say, whoever they are, is the same. They want peace. So ending the violence is the first and single most important thing that's needed to alleviate the human suffering in this country.
Lowcock welcomes the recent announcement by the United States government to review their assistance programs to South Sudan to ensure that the support does not indirectly fuel the conflict. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Workers in South Africa will soon begin construction of a new 100-megawatt solar power plant near the town of Pofadder. In Morocco, expansion of a giant solar plant will soon increase its capacity to 580 megawatts. Solar energy has been slower to arrive in West Africa, but as Brian Postemas reports for VOA from Bamako, growth is underway.
Je voudrais annoncer le lancement du plan solaire dénommé Yelen, qui signifie lumière,
West Africa's largest power station was officially opened in November 2017. It's at Zaktuli, on the outskirts of Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou. It cost $55 million to build. The money came from France and the European Union. Zaktuli now delivers 30 megawatts to the national power grid.
On produit au fil du soleil. Donc, comme vous disiez avant, il n'y a pas de stockage.
Before Zaktuli, this was West Africa's largest, at Bohol in Senegal. It opened in 2016, cost $30 million to build, but the money story here is different. Charlotte Aubin, founder and director of Greenwish, a renewable energy company, was closely involved. She helped create the first independent power producer, or IPP, with money from Senegalese investors and an international fund backed by three European governments.
The first project we did was in Senegal, and it was a milestone for the continent as well as Greenwich, because it was the first solar IPP that came out of the ground in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's now providing electricity to 160,000 people at a 40% discount to the cost of the grid at the time.
40% less? How's that possible? Moussa Koulibaly, who runs Aircom, one of Mali's oldest solar power companies, explains.
C'est l'expansion de la technologie, le fait que les gens ont commencé à...
It's the expansion of the technology, Koulibaly told VOA. The more people want a product, the cheaper it gets. Led by investment from the United States and China, the industry has been rapidly scaling up. Production costs have come down as a result. Koulibaly says he has seen the price of a solar panel reduced by more than 500% in Mali in only 12 years. He says today a solar panel will cost you 50,000 CFA francs. That's about $90. Something else has changed too in the region, the law. Until recently, independent power producers like Aircom and the Greenwich project could not exist. The law simply prohibited it. Senegal lifted the ban on non-state power production in 1998. Mali did it in 2000, while Burkina Faso legalized IPPs only last year. Senegal now has four solar power stations. Burkina Faso is building two more. South Africa and Morocco have dozens each. And the list is getting longer. Kenya, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Ghana, Mauritania. At nighttime, an estimated 600 million Africans still use candles and kerosene lamps to light their homes. Many live in the continent's vast rural zones. How do you get all those millions connected? Charlotte Aubin has an idea that would use existing structures, telephone towers.
There is about 240,000 towers that are off-grid or bad grid that could benefit from clean tech solution, but we are also looking at doing more for population.
Interest in off-grid solar is booming in West Africa. Companies like Aircom in Mali build small local grids tailor-made for the communities they serve. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Bamako.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burundians are voting today, Thursday, in a constitutional amendment referendum that some say, if passed, will keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. Nkurunziza has ruled Burundi since the end of the country's civil war in 2005. And that's it for this Thursday, May 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.